Yeah, welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is a very special guest. This is a different kind of show. In the show today, I got Stephanie Sison on, and we're going to be doing a kind of how to plant your own herbal medicinal garden. Like, fuck the pharmacy, fuck the doctor, grow your own shit, heal yourself, heal your friends. Stephanie is an educator, a permaculturist, an herbalist, a gardener. She also helps run a radio show / podcast called Living Permaculture. She's based out of Basalt, Colorado. She's involved with the Colorado Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute and also a company called Biodynamic Botanicals. So we're just going to mainly talk about how to make your own herbal medicine garden, but also a lot of tangential things related to herbs and plants and health. So check out this interview, and if you dig what Stephanie has to say, you know, you can check her out online, you can go volunteer up there with them in Basalt, or you can go plant your own motherfucking garden. Now, before we get this started, we'll hear from someone in the Channel Zero Podcast Network, and then we'll move on and get into this.
It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Stephanie Sison. Is that how I say your last name?
That is how you say my last name.
Stephanie Sison. Welcome to the Soulcast. Welcome to my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So how's it going today? How are you doing?
Today is a pretty good day. The sun came out after probably 5 days of clouds. So it was a lot colder last night, but I was pretty excited to see the sun, and the greenhouse is super warm. So good day.
So right now you're up there in Basalt, Colorado. Is that where you live?
I am in Basalt, Colorado. And in the winter, I'm up on Basalt Mountain at just shy of 8,000 feet on a completely off-grid homestead that uses micro hydro and solar, and has a big four-season, just shy of tropical climate greenhouse.
Is this the
CRMPI?
Yes,
no, this is not. But we are very close neighbors. So CRMPI, the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, has been up on this mountain for about 30 plus years, and they're just maybe three parcels away.
So this is a separate place where you have a damn near tropical greenhouse?
Right. This is a homestead by Ginger and Rob Jansen, and they've been on this property for about 20 years. And I work with Ginger quite a bit. And when I'm not staying on the biodynamic farm in the summer, then I come up here and help these guys out and stay up on the mountain.
Well, it's so funny because when I first started getting into permaculture, this was like the sexiest thing I could find was these crazy people who are growing bananas at 8,000 feet above sea level. And
right.
I guess you're one of those people.
Yeah. I'm one of those people who really love Colorado, but can't really take a whole winter of gray and white, and very much appreciate being able to be in my shorts and flip-flops and sweating, getting sunshine in the middle of the winter with green plants all around me. We don't have bananas up at this greenhouse, but we have figs and lemons and limes and avocados, and a whole smattering of other herbs. We also do reishi mushrooms, and it has a little aquaponic system, some big fish tanks, things like that.
That's amazing. And you're getting avocado and lemons and all that stuff up there?
Yep, we are.
Jeez, that's so crazy. And right, and are you using the geothermal battery technology in your greenhouse?
Yep, the climate battery. There's a climate battery in this greenhouse for sure.
Just for people who don't know what that is, just to give them an idea of like what's possible with this sort of thinking, like, can you explain how the climate battery works?
Sure. So it's also called the subterranean heating and cooling system, or Jerome Ossentowski, which is really one of the pioneers of it at Krempe. He calls it Polish geothermal. So in essence, in its simplest form, it is a bunch of sewage drainage pipes, a perforated pipe underneath the growing beds in the ground, quite, you know, 3-4 feet down, and various amounts of them at various levels. And what it accomplishes is it has fans that circulate the greenhouse air through the soil. And so it's a really low energy way to moderate both highs and lows in the greenhouse using the stability of the soil temperature.
And the fans, are those like on like a solar sort of thing, or are they?
It depends on the specific greenhouse. We've installed them in many different styles. Some people are on the grid and some are not. The fans are all on a thermostat, so they only trigger under certain parameters. And at this homestead, all the electricity is produced here with the solar and hydro, so it's just plugged into the main system. And the Permaculture Institute has it that way as well. They just have a solar system, and it's just plugged into the main facility.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's so, because there's like one of the guys, and just for people who are listening, you know, you were one of the instructors for a number of classes we've had at this permaculture design certificate course that I'm taking in Colorado, and it's been fucking amazing. Like every I went into the class like having done all this research, thinking like, you know, thinking I knew a lot, and every day I'm just, every time I come home, I'm always just overwhelmed with like, oh my God, now I'm going to go in this whole other direction with my life.
Now you have all this other stuff to learn.
It's awesome.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun, and really the courses really open you up to so many possibilities for every site, everywhere. They really get your brain going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got to say, some of the stuff that you were teaching just really was like, I don't know, some of my favorite. And
thank you.
And the shit that really, you know, was interesting, like, you know a lot about vegetables and propagating trees or whatever, but a lot of the work you do is around medicinal herb growing and biodynamic growing styles. So I guess before we talk about the medicinal stuff, How do you define biodynamic? I had never even heard that term until.
Well, like permaculture, probably it has a way too long of an answer. But the short of it, from my perspective, it is a style of agriculture and farm or site management that comes from Rudolf Steiner out of Germany, which Steiner is the same person who created the Waldorf school system. Biodynamics holds within it requirements for the farm to be acknowledging that it is an alive entity, the farm itself. And so a lot of permaculture practices are used as well, key lining, a lot of organic practices. It has to be all chemical free. There's great composting, all of these kind of tangible seen elements that it takes to be a good, healthy, strong farm. But then it very specifically includes the spiritual element and looking to the stars and the unseen things, energies, intention. So the kind of tagline, I guess, for that and the Waldorf school is just that everything matters. How I feel when I plant a seed, if I'm all grumpy pants or I'm feeling really happy and joyous and loving that day, that matters to the seed, to the plant, to the medicine, to the person who eats it, you know, months, years down the road. And from me and how I feel about a seed all the way through every step, my intention and what I put into my activities on the farm and everyone's activities on the farm matter to the farm and to the products and things that we create from it.
And do you, I mean, I know this is whatever kind of a, but do you notice like a noticeable difference in, like, you know, when you're like, for instance, people talk about, you know, they've tested plants, whether people sing to them or whether they don't sing to them. And if they sing to them, the plants grow better.
Right.
Are there like measurable things that you can point to that you're like, oh, this is when I realized that this is how I wanted to do it?
Sure. And on the singing front, that I think for a long time was maybe just a concept or a belief that people had. And now even in labs, we're starting to be able to read with our instruments that the stomata underneath the leaves open up and uptake more nutrients when certain styles of music or singing happens around these plants. So we can even see it that way. But with biodynamics, a lot of the stuff that we will see are better germination rates, quicker germination rates. The planting calendar is a common thing that people will start using with biodynamics that pays attention to the movement of the moon, the different planets, and what's happening in an astrological kind of concept and out in the universe. And then there are days when they recommend that you do certain things. And you can see pretty quickly radishes that you plant on a root day just tend to have much better root development versus if you were to plant them on a flower day. Oftentimes they're going to go to flower a lot quicker. And a lot of that has to do with the movement of water. So why we're paying attention to the moon, among many other reasons, is the moon pulls water and moves water. And our plants, our bodies, we're very much filled with water. And so those things affect us. One thing that they've done a really great testing on with this is root storage. So your potatoes, your beets, your onions, your things that you're going to store in your cellar or your root cellar over the winter, picked on a day when the water is not in the root, those roots will last longer, which makes sense. Less water.
Yeah, that's, and so with biodynamics, you're mostly harvesting by the moon, right? That's where the harvest moon comes from. Right? Is that right? Or
right, that's definitely a part of it. Yeah, that's a part of it for sure.
What sort of brought you to you know, cultivating medicinal herbs and or, like, you know, why do you prefer this over pharmaceuticals, which is an obvious question, but
but a good one.
Yeah. So
I came to medicinal herbs quite a while after I had started learning about permaculture and food growing and learning how to provide for myself that way. And I was really looking to take that to the next level. In addition, I think one of the big selling points, I just got back from Costa Rica at a permaculture farm and doing some river guiding. And I had staph infection and it had gotten into my bloodstream, and I got tested that I had staph infection and went to a natural herb store that was near me at the time with this really amazing gentleman who runs it with his family. And he recommended activated charcoal powder and psyllium seed and some hot and cold water treatments. And within a week and a half, I saw no more signs of the staph. And then about 3 weeks later, I went and got checked again. And the staph had gone completely from my body, and I didn't take any antibiotics for it at all. And so I already liked the idea of treating things naturally. But as I started to have experiences like that with myself or my daughter or friends and family, I really started seeing the strength and power in these things. And coming from a place where I'm wanting to be more in charge of my own health and also empower other people to do so. These herbs, they are beautiful. They grow so well in so many different climates, and they're right there waiting for us to use them. And they are our powerhouses. These are our vitamins, minerals, pharmaceuticals, but we can grow them right outside our door and use them within our own kitchen and really help ourselves and our families be healthier and happier. So that was really appealing for me. And as I started to get more into learning about the plants, but really working with the plants and creating those kind of intimate relationships, they are so beautiful and they're so diverse and wild genetically. A lot of our medicinal herbs are still very close to their wild counterparts in genetics, if not exactly the same, as opposed to some of our vegetable crops who have been bred for so long to be so far away from how they were in the wild. Herbs are really still very much wild, and their flower structures and scents and colors are just beautiful and arousing and just grab me in a way that I love veggies, but I love growing herbs.
That's awesome. And I mean, do you think there's something to be said about, you know, what you're saying about these herbs that, you know, we've co-evolved, you know, they're wild on one hand, but on the other hand, you know, they've co-evolved with humans for hundreds of thousands of years as through selective breeding, and people have been, you know, keeping these medicinal herbs going for, you know, as long as we've had language.
Absolutely. And I think the really thing that's interesting about the medicinal is because we're going for potency, that as we've selected over the years, they've been selected for that. So there hasn't been the watering down, like arugula, for instance, is a good example, or our common lettuce that was bred from wild lettuce and used to be, the wild lettuce is so bitter and so full of secondary metabolites and all these different chemical constituents, and it makes it a very, very strong medicine. But as we bred it for food, our interest in that breeding has been palatability, has been a sweeter flavor, less bitterness, less bolting to flour, bigger heads, color variations, things like that. And with the medicinals, plants that have been used for health and medicine for a very, very long time, that is our singular goal with them. The only kind of watering down of genetics as far as strength goes that we're seeing now is because they're so pretty that the ornamental trade has grabbed a bunch of them, like echinacea is probably one that the listeners have commonly seen in ornamental gardens. And those genetics have been selected now for a while for big, beautiful flowers, and that tends to be at risk of the medicinal constituents, but most of the rest of them have been selected over time for their strength as medicine.
And in most of our medicinal, I was listening to some of the other interviews that you've done recently, and most of the medicinal herbs that we're using are actually, like, when you go to the natural food store, 90% of the time it's coming from China, and we're not, like, you know, there's a shortage of this stuff being produced at home, correct?
Absolutely. For our companies that make medicinal herb products that are on the shelves, almost 80% of the herbs that they're utilizing are coming from outside of this country. And these are plants that we can very easily grow within the country. And one, that's going to shorten the supply chain and allow these herbs to be consumed quicker. And so they'll be more potent that way. But fossil fuel emissions, and there's just all kinds of issues with that scale of importation when we have the ability to do all of this right here. And we, including almost everyone who has even a garden box, can grow a fair amount of medicinals that'll help improve the health of their family.
Well, I mean, that's the main reason I wanted to interview you today, was just to kind of give people an idea of, like, how easy it is to plant your own pharmacy in your backyard. And so I kind of just wanted to do like a quick little dummies guide on how to do it. Sure. So I guess I wanted to focus on herbs or medicinal plants that grow in climate zone 5 or, you know, are temperate, for temperate regions. So places that have seasons or places that, you know, if it works here, most likely it'll work in most places. So, yeah, I guess I just wanted to ask you a couple different, I don't know, what's the best way to do that? Should we talk about just like, you know, how do we dig it? Do we dig it in like a little box? Do you recommend like herb spirals? Do you think that's a good way for someone to do their first medicine garden? Like what do you think for someone who's, you know, living on a tiny bit of land or has a little bit of property to work with? What do you think the best way to get a medicine garden started or to start growing medicinals?
Sure. I think it would probably largely depend on what that space looks like. But most of our, well, really all of our medicinals, it just, if you have shade or if you have a lot of sun or if you have a wet place or a dry place, are going to help kind of you decide what it is that's going to work. But let's assume someone has a 10 by 10 section of yard that gets fairly decent sun and they can get some water to it. If we can assume those kind of things, so it'd be most neighborhoods, small yard. I think the herb spirals actually work very well when built appropriately. And so if your listeners haven't have you talked about herb spirals before?
Nope.
Do you want me to give you the briefing?
Yeah, that'd be cool. That'd be awesome.
Okay. So an herb spiral is literally a spiral of garden bed. So instead of doing like your square or what have you, and it is a raised bed, but it goes up towards the center. So it's going around in a circle, but also vertically up. And what that does is create a really great example of microclimates. And so you'll have everything at the bottom that will stay more wet. Things more at the top will be more dry because the water would be running away from those things. The plants on the backside, the north side, would be shadier and colder, and things on the south side would be warmer and sometimes drier because of the way that the sun beats down on it. That's just kind of a real general overview of it. And so you can get all these little tiny microclimates and plant your herbs based on what they need around that. That's a really great way to go, but our herbs are so diverse that another really nice way to do it is to just go around your structure. So if you have a small house and you've got a south side that gets warm, just budding these herbs right up against your house on all the sides kind of would allow you to have everything. If you have a section with a hose bib, that almost always people have drippy hoses at one point or another, those are really great locations for your mints and your nettles and things that really enjoy that more wet climate. And we can certainly go in, if you'd like, into more specifics about varieties and what they like or what they're good for, just depending on where you want to take this.
Yeah, I mean, what are some of your favorite, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about this perspective from like, you know, the anarchist perspective. The world is currently ending. Obamacare or Trump care, it's like we could lose it any day. How can we take care of ourselves? You know, how can we grow things that can keep us alive?
Sure.
With that in mind, what would be some of your favorite plants to put in this garden?
Okay. And all of these will be appropriate for almost all climates, and especially ours around here. So I'll preface that. Yarrow would be, so Achillea millifolium, that would be one of my top herbs for a survival or just take care of yourself type of garden. It's a plant that is native to here. It grows wild, but it also is a beautiful perennial that one will attract pollinators and beneficial insects to your garden. So it'll be good to have around for your vegetable garden to keep the pests kind of at bay. But yarrow is a plant that can deal with wet but also can very easily adapt to a dry climate, almost making it much stronger. So you're like rockier, drier sections of your yard or wherever you have to plant. This is a rapid blood coagulator, and so it's going to help staunch bleeding. That's going to be one of its big claims to fame, is if you get cut and you're bleeding out, to chew up this plant and then spit it onto your cut, and it will stop your bleeding. It's also called nosebleed oftentimes for the same reason. It can stop your nosebleed. And it's extremely antiseptic, so it's going to also help clean the wound to assure that you're not getting some kind of infection in there. The other use of yarrow is more from an allergenic standpoint, so internally. It's a great tea that helps to drain mucus from the sinuses, especially those sinus headaches that really get between your eyebrows and you're feeling all full up there in the brain of phlegm. It's a beautiful plant to help release that out.
It's an expectorant.
So that's going to be... Yeah, so it is an expectorant, but specifically, like, there's some expectorants that are much more associated with the lungs. And so when you get that, like, lung mucus stuff, to get that out, I would use a different herb. But yarrow is just really around this head congestion.
Cool. And yarrow also gets its name from...
So the warrior Achilles, it comes... So Achillea millefolium is its Latin, and it... is said that the warrior Achilles would never go into battle without yarrow for his soldiers because of that rapid blood coagulator effect, because it really is a survival plant. It can save your life, definitely.
And it's crazy. It's crazy because I always see soap in my bathroom and it always says it's like organic, all natural with anti-infectant or disinfectant qualities and da 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 da. And I'm like, it's crazy that plants, that herbs can provide those qualities. You know, it's, I would think that that's more of like a magical chemical process. You know,
sometimes now, or oftentimes now, it is some magic chemical process, but most of our knowledge and our pharmaceuticals originally came from herbs anyhow and wild botanicals. So like aspirin is a really common thing that people are very well aware of that now is made chemically, but for a long time it was made just from willow bark. So willow bark is a great pain reliever, and that's how we created aspirin originally. Now it's not made that way, but
It's not made that way anymore.
It's not made with willow bark anymore. It is a factory chemical laboratory creation at this point that has lots of side effects because of that. It's very, very rough on the digestive tract, which is something that willow bark doesn't have those same side effects. And so we're going to see that a lot is when we are using these wild medicinals, and they've got, you know, their own contradictions. But this is a plant that has any of these plants. They have thousands of chemical constituents, and we as a people tend to want to figure out what part of that is good. So turmeric with curcumin is probably the most trendy example of this right now. We love turmeric. Turmeric's anti-inflammatory. It's great for the brain. It's the curcumin. We have decided in a lab that the curcumin is the thing that makes turmeric work. And now we're seeing supplements with these thousands and thousands of milligrams of curcumin. And while that's a powerful part of the plant, there's so many chemical reactions going on with all of the different constituents that it provides a very safe, effective package. And when we start pulling out these pieces, thinking that we have figured out how to do it better than the plant, we tend to get ourselves in trouble over and over again.
Yeah. I just saw a trailer for this new movie, Geostorm, and, human beings sure can fuck things up.
Because we're so smart.
All right, so we got some yarrow in there.
Okay.
What else?
So probably the next one I would absolutely have is going to be, I would say, comfrey, which is a great answer for the permaculturalists because we love some comfrey, great for our garden, great fertilizer for our plants, and also a rapid cell regenerator. So I'm still kind of staying in this wound section for a moment. So this is going to help heal wounds quicker than they would without it. The only issue with comfrey is that you're going to need to make sure that that wound is clean because it can heal it so fast that sometimes it can heal it right over, and close over an infection. So you just have to be a little bit watchful for that. But that's a really beautiful plant, grows prolifically. If you have a little bit, you will have plenty for your family and your friends and your garden, and it's great food for your chickens. So it's another kind of multi-purpose plant that can grow in the sun, but also in a pretty decent amount of shade. I would say my next top is going to be two plants that people find very regularly. They can find them wild if they have a clean enough place. Otherwise, they're probably, especially dandelion, is going to be growing probably in your yard, whether you like it or not. So dandelion and burdock are going to be probably my two big digestive herbs that I can't do without. So they're going to be, on one hand, really great for digestive upset, rebuilding the digestive tract, leaky gut, any kind of issue as far as that goes, but also for detoxing the body and supporting the liver and our other detoxification organs. So if you're have toxicity in any way, burdock is a great heavy metal binder. It's going to move through your body and bind with heavy metals and move them out. Any other kind of toxins that are kind of floating around, it's really useful, as well as dandelion, for just improving our whole elimination system. Those two are pretty big powerhouses that, again, practically grow themselves, which is, I'm always a fan of that.
And burdock is actually, right, that's a good, nice root vegetable to eat.
Also. It's a nice food too, yeah. Which is handy. And it also is a great bioremediation plant. So if you're working on a piece of property that you don't want to eat off for a little while, but you're wanting to clean up, burdock is a great plant to start that process and really start healing the soil and the land to be healthier for when you would want to grow food there at some point.
What about... it's so crazy. I've seen burdock, but I've never tried to grow it before, but now I want to. Because lead and fucking... Well, if it'll get the lead out of my water, that's great.
At least out of your body, yeah.
I mean, if it works that way, that'd be... Does it work that way?
It does. You take it internally, and it the type of fiber that's in it will bind, and you won't digest it. It'll push through, but it sucks up these toxins as it goes through your body.
Cool.
Yeah. So, and there's lots of others, like in combination, if you're really trying to eliminate metal toxicity in some way, that you can create a formula that would really hit it on many different fronts, just supporting one binding, but also supporting your own elimination system and your own detox system.
You know, I wonder if there's any like bioremediated minded people in Detroit or in some of these Rust Belt cities that are breaking down, thinking about using burdock.
And there's quite a few, and unfortunately, almost all of them are on this hit list of the whole invasive weed category, and so most of the it is a bit dramatic when you read some of the literature on the invasive weeds and the language that's used around these like invading species that are, you know, that it's just a really, really kind of, even the way most of these documents are, the words that they're using are this really dramatic angle on plants that are in essence not hurting the land. They're actually cleaning the land. And almost all of them are popping up on these pieces of land that we as a society have decimated and destroyed soil quality to a level that almost nothing can grow there except this category of plants that are there to heal and clean this mess up that mostly we've created. And so it's just a very interesting and super hot button topic to start talking about with folks, because they're either on one side or the other, or they don't know much about it at all. But the people who are on the invasive weed side and seeing that as a huge issue are very hot about it. And the from a holistic standpoint, most of them are healing that land, and most of them are also really beautiful detoxifiers for our own bodies. And we all are living in a much more toxic world, so it's really not a surprise that these plants are becoming so prolific.
But, well, not only that, but what is nature but, you know, disturbance and disruption like that, you know?
Well, and a lot of the whole kind of concept behind it is that we decided at some point that we're going to take a snapshot of a certain area, and what's native there at that point is what we should always try to keep there. And that's just not how the world works, whether we're involved or not. Climate changes, rainfall patterns, all kinds of things shift. Birds move seeds around and around, and these are not static systems. They never were, and they never will be. So to try to keep them in place in some artificial time that we decided what this plant population should look like, one, I don't think is actually wise, but two, it's going to be very difficult to achieve.
I know. All right. Well, what other plants, what are some good plants to throw in there for stress?
Sure. Which is a great category. I love this category. We've got so many lovely medicinals, and this is a category where most of them taste really good too. So that's always nice. So probably my top two that I would use for more universally applied. So children, elderly, grown-ups, anyone who's dealing with physical stress, but really emotional, mental kind of stress. And those two would be skullcap, American skullcap. And so that's going to be a beautiful plant in the mint family, grows great in a little bit of shade with a little bit of water. And this is going to be a plant that you want to consume either fresh as a tea or tincture it fresh. And so this is one of our premier nervings, really, really rebuilding to the nervous system, but specifically calming to it. So they've had really great success with folks who grind their teeth at night, for instance, which is usually a nervous system issue. People with epilepsy and seizure disorders, it's been huge. And for folks who just have general anxiety issues. The other one, which might be surprising to listeners, is a plant they're familiar with, not in this form, but oats, like oatmeal. It's Avena sativa. So this is the plant that makes the oats for your oatmeal. But we're going to be harvesting the oat seed head when it's still green and what they call milky. So you'll see it as milky oats if it's on a tincture butter or something like that. And so you wait until the seed head is just coming out and it's real green and it fills up with this milk, not like a milk, like an oat milk that you would drink in the store. It's like maybe just a few drops in each little seed head. And so that's going to be one of our best nervous system rebuilders that helps with the myelin sheath and is more like a long-term usage food herb. And food herbs are really great because you don't have to worry about so many interactions. You don't have to worry about how long you take it or how much you take it or who you give it to. It's super safe for long-term usage and really needs to be something you use long-term and really helpful for folks who have a damaged nervous system or really any of us who live in a much higher stress lifestyle than maybe we would like. Just will subtly come in there and just soften the edges and start rebuilding the way that our brain and our nervous system fires and softening those connections and messages coming through.
Damn. Yeah, I've never thought about growing oat, really. I mean, is it easy to grow?
It's so easy. It's so easy. But you have to make sure you plant it in a row, though, because for a while it just looks like grass because it is a grass. So you're like, oh, there's grass in my garden. But it's really the oats. And they come up really fast. I can get out here, which we are more like zone 4 if on a good year. I can get 2 plantings of oats in usually in a regular season. They're very, very quick. And you're going to get 2 things out of that, or 3 if you like. So we're mainly going for those milky oats. But you can also then, after you harvest the milky oats, harvest the straw, which is often used by companies in nutrition blends, like some kind of tea. We have it in our company with a nourishing tea, so it would be our vitamin and mineral tea. It doesn't have the same nervous system rebuilding qualities that the milky oat seed head does, but it's full of vitamins and minerals and just really, really good for general health. And then if you want to push it all the way and you don't quite get to harvesting all those seed heads in time, you're going to get the grain, the oat grain. And that's something, if you get the hullless oats, that you can then mill yourself or allow for your chickens to have lots of lovely food. And you also get, again, if you don't harvest all that you planted, you get the straw at a later stage, and it can be used for bedding or organic matter or mulch in your garden. Really great multi-purpose crop. A lot of times you'll see it, farmers will be using it as a cover crop just to add organic matter back to their fields in between their regular commodity crops.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just love oats anyway. I just love oatmeal.
Good. It's like, you know, and the plant's just good all the way around. And it really competes really well with weeds. So because it can get in and get started so quickly and shade the ground. I really like oats. We did about 1.5 acres of them on the farm last year.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was just had some oatmeal with my son this morning, and it was fun. It was fun watching him eat oatmeal.
That's what our rule here is. It's if it's a school day for years, it's oatmeal. There's no discussion. There's no any if ands or buts. It makes my life 10 times easier. Like there might be a different fruit on it periodically or a different nut in it, but it is oats every school day forever and always until my daughter totally denies my ability to control that for her.
Awesome. Yeah, until she can learn to make her own coming. Eggs.
Yeah. If she wants to make her own scrambled eggs and get up early enough to do that every morning, then sure, she can make me some too.
Okay.
I think the probably other stress herb that I find most useful would be motherwort, Leonoris cardacea, which stands for lionheart. This is much more specific to the type of stress or anxiety. If you feel that like in your chest where you get panicky and short of breath and it just feels right there in your chest where your stress lives, this would be the herb for that. Also in the mint family, sun or shade, fine. Better with a little water, but can also deal with some drought. Really, really beautiful and great for bumblebees. So your honeybees, your bees are going to be all over this motherwort.
Yeah, I've never heard of motherwort, but I'm looking at it online. It's right now, it's very pretty.
Yeah, it's very pretty. Nice perennial. You can get multiple cuttings per season. It's a little bit more bitter than the others. So something that if you're using it in a tea, maybe either sweetening that up a bit with some honey or diluting it with something a little bit more yummy, like peppermint or something like that. I like the bitterness, but it takes a little getting used to sometimes.
Nice. All right. Well, what about for sickness or immunity? What would be a good plants, some good plants to throw in there for sickness or immunity?
So I'd say there's a couple different kind of ways to look at that. One would be from a preventative standpoint. So if it's cold and flu season, we always, always have on hand elderberries, astragalus, and rosehip that we make into a syrup, elderberry syrup. So during the cold and flu season, or if you're at work or your kids are at school and everybody's all snot faced and coughing all over each other and the flu starts to move around, this is the time that you start taking this right away, ahead of when you get sick, and almost always will prevent that from getting a hold of you. Those are some really, and those are really nice herbs and plants. Also elderberry is going to be more like a shrub, really beautiful, big, beautiful flowers, lovely berries. You want the Sambucus nigra, the black, or also the blue, the European elder, not our native red elder. So if folks are out wild harvesting and they see red elderberries, that would be a plant that we don't want to be harvesting for medicine. It has a lot, all elderberries are slightly, have a slight toxicity level, but in the others, it's very, very low. And once you cook them, it's not an issue at all. And our red elder is just much higher. So it's going to be really hard on the digestive tract. Folks are going to really give themselves a nice belly ache if they consume our native one.
Yeah, it's funny because I threw in elderberries, I don't know, middle of the summer on the, I don't even know, I think the north side of my house. And they grew the best. I mean, that plant is fucking amazing.
It's amazing. And you can make a million more elderberry plants out of your elderberry plant. You just take like a cutting and stick it in some water and boom, you got roots and a whole new plant. It's a beautiful, aggressive plant. I don't think it's aggressive to the point that it takes over a space uncontrollably, but aggressive in the best sense of the word.
But it does seem like when people talk about immunity stuff that elderberry is like the number, elderberry flowers, elderberry berries are the number one.
And they've been doing lots of studies on elderberries over the past couple of years, and they're showing that it's effective against 8 or 9 different strains of the flu, which is way more than anything else people could possibly access. And that's only the ones that we know of. So it just... rather than like a flu shot, which has all kinds of different downsides, one just being that by the time we make it, usually it's for a strain of the flu that no longer is the one that we're suffering from anyway. So it's kind of outdated information once it's gone through the pharmaceutical company. And the elderberries are just much more dynamic and applicable. They're extremely antiviral. I know when one of the recent, like, I don't know, SARS or one of those big viruses that was hitting the news everywhere and everybody was freaking out, you could not find a single elderberry on the entire expanse of the internet for a solid 3 months. So this is a really important one to get going at your house, because when you really need it and it's more like an epidemic type illness going around, you probably won't be able to buy them.
Damn. Yeah, totally.
Goes fast. That's crazy. And then from more of a like a treatment perspective, I think two of my favorite herbs for more of your coughs and cold type issues, or I guess three. So I've got two beautiful herbs for our lung issues and mucus problems. So marshmallow, which is from, like, we originally made marshmallows out of this plant before they became their high fructose corn syrup version that they exist as today. And so they're also really fun to grow with kids because they're like, what, we're going to grow marshmallows? And so you can use the flower, the leaves, or specifically the root. And this is going to be really mucilaginic. So it's going to calm an irritated lung system. And then it's also going to loosen and moisten so that any kind of dry coughs, all of that can kind of move around and get out of you a little bit easier. And it's, the flavor is really mild. And this is something that has a very specific best way to consume it, though, because these mucilaginic herbs are usually better as a cold infusion. So almost always you're going to see things infused hot in some way, like a tea. And that heat helps to bring out the medicinal constituents. But in this instance, we're going to be looking for this mucilaginic compound. And so that's going to come out in cold water. So if you take this marshmallow root and you pour, you know, a glass of cold water over it and let it sit for a few minutes, the water will end up being kind of like snot, very gooey and slimy, depending on how thick it is. And that's the magic. That gooey, slimy stuff is what really, really helps your throat and your lungs to soften and heal. Sounds gross, I know, but I mean, it's good.
Well, at least you're telling us how to use it, because everything else I just assume goes into tea or an alcohol extract tincture.
Right. And this is just one that's just very specific. So I'll try to point those out. Elecampane would be one of my other, really one of my top expectorant herbs. So when you're getting that mucus down in the lungs that just does not want to move and it's just wet and you're worried about bronchitis and you're worried about it going deeper, this is one of the herbs that will help to move that out. And it's a beautiful yellow flower. We're going to be using the root specifically, but just a really lovely looking flower as well.
Wait, elecampane is marshmallow root, right?
No. Mm-mm. So two different plants. I switched up on you.
Okay.
So marshmallow root is a different plant, and elecampane, Inula helenulum, is elecampane. Marshmallow is going to be similar plant. To – what's that?
The elecampane is another pretty kind of daisy-looking thing.
Yeah, exactly. Marshmallow is going to look a lot like a hollyhock, except tinier. So similar leaf structure, similar flower structure, but the flowers are much, much, much smaller and more white, and as opposed to our hollyhocks, which have these big, big, beautiful blossoms of all different colors. Which you can use also in the same way. They're not quite as strong as marshmallow, but they can be used for lung issues as well.
All right. Here's a random question I got online when I announced that I was doing this interview. And
sure.
I know you're not really qualified to give doctor advice on here, but this is from someone online. I've been on a proton pump inhibitor for over a decade, and I know that it will destroy my liver and kidneys in the long run, but it solves the problem in the short term. Mm-hmm. I want to switch to natural medicines, but I have no experience at all. And I've always lived in urban areas. So, I mean, is there anything that comes in your mind as you hear that?
Sure.
And his problem is acid reflux specifically.
Right. Because he's already gone down this mainstream medical road, and this is going to be a really great reason to try your herbs before you try your pharmaceuticals. So once you start taking pharmaceuticals or start down that road, you're really going to need to talk to someone and get a relationship with a naturopath or a clinical herbalist to talk about how to switch or move away from what you've already started doing with the pharmaceuticals into more of a holistic remedy and care. If we could, and that would be someone he just needs to really work with someone very specifically. But if we could back up a bit, and this is probably what he'll end up doing once someone has safely backed him out of where he's gone so far, is using more of those digestive herbs to heal and strengthen our entire digestive tract and to rebalance the acids and all the chemicals that our body produces to digest food and start fixing the damage that's been done. So our plantain, calendula, all these really soft kind of wound healing, because it's wounded, but it's on the inside. So we think of wounds being on the outside, but our gut is kind of like our second skin, or the second way we interface with the world. And so we want to heal all of this damage that's been created over the years, one from the acid reflux itself, but also to get us back so that's not an issue for us anymore and our digestive tract works better. So I would, because he's at a certain level, I would say these softer more gentle food-like herbs like plantain and calendula are going to be where he's going to start to really heal. And then once the healing has taken place, starting to use a little bit more aggressive bitters and digestive herbs that help to really like rebuild the strength of the digestive tract would be my guess. But everybody is so different and responds so differently. And things interact with what we're doing already. So just to probably see a specialist would be my recommendation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was hesitant to even ask that because it sounded so specific, but I thought it was, you know.
When it's useful to bring up that point that it becomes more complicated because there are so many drug herb interactions that once we start heading down the pharmaceutical path, it's not at all impossible, and I highly recommend backing out, but having some help with that on a regular basis where someone can really dial in on what you're up to on a daily basis and how to move you to a healthier place without messing anything up, I think is important. But before you get there, using herbs there are some herbs that are less safe than others, but generally, and especially the herbs that I'm talking about here today are really, really, accepted by many people. As long as you're marginally healthy and you just got a little bit going on here and there, and you're not taking any pharmaceuticals, they work beautifully to restore health because they are really supporting our body's own healing. And so the side effect issue it's not a big problem for the most part.
Right. And okay. Well, so far we have, I don't know, like 13 plants that you've dropped, and that's, you know, that pretty much fills a spiral herb garden. It's like a little plot right there. Is there anything else that you're like, as I'm listing off all these plants, plantain, calendula, oat, motherwort, astragalus, marshmallow, skullcap, dandelion, burdock, elecampane, yarrow, is there like, oh shit, another couple plants that you love that I mean, of course you'd probably throw in another 40 if you could,
but... I'll limit it to a couple. So I think nettle deserves stinging nettle deserves a shout out for a couple reasons.
Peace out to stinging nettle.
Yeah, to my homies. So nettle is going to be extremely helpful for allergies for folks, and that's something that people really, really suffer with. So it's a great antihistamine, works very quickly. And so a lot of these herbs are really going to be cumulative. You take them over a long period of time, like the oats, and then you have this subtle, really profound healing over time. Nettle is going to be a plant that you are sneezing like crazy, full of phlegm, eyes watering. You drink a super strong cup of nettle tea or take a bunch of the tincture, and you're going to see a very quick response in the antihistamine category. You're really going to notice that. So that's really beautiful. But the other side of it, from a nutrition perspective, one, it helps the body assimilate iron. So really good for folks who are vegetarian to consume on a regular basis. It is one of those food herbs, extremely high in vitamins and minerals, and absolutely delicious. If you ever have a dish you're making with spinach, like a sog or a spinach artichoke dip or something like that, and you either cut the spinach and add nettle or do some combination of it, you will never go back to not having nettle if you can help it. Nettle is a beautiful, beautiful food that's flavorful and completely nutritious and just a really great plant to have around. And once it hits heat, the stingers are non-existent anymore, so people don't have to worry about stinging their mouth. Once you saute it or put hot water on it, you're not going to have the stinging issue anymore. Yeah, so that would be up there. Go ahead.
That's awesome. No, I never knew anything about nettle until I was like pulling off the road in the UK to take a piss one day.
And then you found out the hard way.
Yeah. I plowed into a whole bush of like nettle, and they're like, oh my God, mate, what have you done? I'm like, what is this? This hurts.
And plantain, you got to find yourself some plantain if you get into the nettle, and that will help kind of calm the sting down if you can make some plantain poultices and rub them all over yourself.
Nice.
So something in the mint family besides, there's a lot we talked about in the mint family, but more like a peppermint spearmint kind of plant. People are really used to these. They might even have them already and just think of it because it's a yummy peppermint tea that tastes really good, but they're very, very good for the digestive tract, really good for upset bellies. They also help from more of aromatherapy perspective. They're really mood elevating. And I don't know if we talked about this, but I work with the Rifle Corrections Facility with the prison workers and do a lot of garden work with those guys. And anytime we get a new fella to the crew, and especially if he's like grumpy pants, which he's got probably plenty of reason to be grumpy, the first thing we have them do is weed the peppermint bed, and it is a matter of minutes and they will be completely smiling. It works every time. You just cannot be around these plants with all of that, our olfactory senses just getting hit with this peppermint oil, and not turn that frown upside down. So it's a beautiful plant that way too.
Well, since you I'd like to ask you some questions about that since you mentioned it, but we'll go back to that.
Sure.
What about Tulsi?
Maybe I'll just give you Tulsi. Yep. I was going to jump into the annuals that I would recommend. And calendula are the two.
So let me just cut you off right there. So all these plants that we've talked about, the perennials, that means if it doesn't fall below 20 degrees in the root, negative 20 degrees in the root, chances are these are going to come back.
Yes, in our climate, all of these that I mentioned will come back year after year after year. Some of them are more short-lived, like a 5 to 7 year lifespan, and then some of them are much, much longer, 10, 20 years. You'll have a patch of motherwort living and growing beautifully.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
That's- so Tulsi. Is one of my absolute favorite annuals, and this is a basil, so you really have to love this one because you're going to have to start it in our climate anyway. You're going to have to start it early inside or buy some starts from a friend. You can save your own seed at the end of the season, but these will not last the season over. And they are perennial in the proper climate, as many annuals are, but in our climate, they are not frost tolerant. So if we get that funky June freeze, hopefully it'll just burn the tips and it'll come back, but it could easily annihilate your Tulsi patch. So this is a plant that you're going to have to pay a little bit more attention to, and take note of the weather if you want to keep it outside all the time, and start it early and try to harvest as much as you can during the season. So it does take some extra effort compared to the other guys, but it is absolutely worth the effort. For one, it's delicious. Kids like it. Everybody really enjoys, or most people really enjoy the flavor of Tulsi, again, in the mint family. So this is going to be an herb that is in the adaptogen category. And for anyone who doesn't know what that category means, it means that the plant can be used long term. It also means that it has to have a non-specific effect on systems. So as opposed to a plant that is very stimulating to the metabolism or to the mind, for instance, or sedative, so makes you sleepy or what have you, an adaptogen has to bring you into balance. So it's Tulsi, and if your mind is racing, it will help to calm it, and if your mind is sleepy, it will help to speed it up. So it brings balance to systems. Oftentimes we're talking about hormone systems as well. So it brings you into kind of homeostasis, so to speak. Each adaptogen kind of has an affinity for a certain system. Like astragalus would be one that has an affinity for the immune system, but Tulsi is helpful for the immune system as well as being really, really helpful for the brain. It helps increase blood flow in the brain. So beautiful for focus, anxiety, It's great for stamina for people. It's a really hot herb right now too. So if someone's looking to grow a crop that they would have no problem selling to their friends or their neighborhood, tulsi would be a really important one from that respect. It's very, very desired currently.
And it's a very gourmet tasting plant.
It is.
I mean, whenever I make it, I'm like, God, this is like chai or something. Like, this tastes
and depending on which variety you grow and also where it's grown, it's really one of the plants that I found that I can tell pretty quickly if it was grown. I can't tell really from like the east to more like Oregon, Washington, but I can tell the difference between tulsi grown in a drier climate with soils more like ours versus in a place that has really, really high water and high organic matter. It almost tastes like dirty, but in a really good way as well. And then ours here tends to taste much more floral and kind of, I don't want to say astral, but it's a lighter, more, I guess floral flavor here, and also has these like really interesting licorice notes. It's complex. Some people do use it. It is a basil. So like our culinary basil, same family. But just really the scent is just overwhelming. Really beautiful.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I somehow fucked up and like I labeled my Thai basil as holy basil also, so I got a double. I was like, oh wait, this is definitely not Thai basil, but they look.
Yeah, and Thai basil is super strong too.
Yeah, well, I didn't get any this year. All my Thai basil tasted like licorice, so be it.
guess it was tulsi.
Yeah. So, all right. So, if people are interested in like growing all this, grow all these things, like, and they want to do a spiral or a whatever, when's a good time? Like, let's say, like how far before their first frost? How soon should they start planting this? Like, you know.
Probably depends on which one they're going to do, and what they're interested in. There are certain, crops that need very specific conditions if they're going to start them from seed, like cold conditioning and things like that. But generally most of these things I'm starting within the next 4 weeks, and our last frost date I like to pretend is May 15th. That's not actually really true, because our last frost date last year was June 15th, but that's my wishful thinking at work. And so I've started already, quite a few flats, but I'll be doing that over the next 4 weeks because I want to have some nice sized plants. Generally, especially for a small garden, it's just best to start them by seed and get them up to a decent size and then plant them out right around your last frost date. Most of these plants, except the tulsi, are going to be plants that can handle a frost anyway. And even if they frost tip burn, as long as they're of a marginal size, like a 4-inch pot, they don't have to be that big. They're gonna bounce back just fine. So you don't really have to baby them like you would your vegetables.
Awesome. And so when people, they've harvested all this stuff, they've grown it, they're psyched about it. Is it as simple as like just hanging it up to dry in a dry place and then making tea or making a tincture? Is that how?
Yeah, absolutely. So just hang it in a cool, dry place that's shady, preferably, because you really want to retain as much of the active constituents in there as possible, and sun will deplete some of that. And then to store, I'd recommend then you crush it in some fashion. We call it garbling. And so we'd be crushing it into some grade that would be easier to use for tea or just easier to store. In reference to tinctures, though, if this is home scale and if possible, the best way to do a tincture is with the fresh herb. So you take your herbs and you harvest them and you put some aside to dry for your teas or for later use, but right away get some of that into some alcohol and start tincturing it, because you're going to get so much more out of the plant chemically and much different properties sometimes by doing them fresh. So the two that are probably the most important that we talked about to tincture fresh are those nervines for stress, the oats in its milky stage and the skullcap. They're much different tinctured dry than tinctured fresh. And if you really want the nervous system rebuilding qualities, the fresh is the way to go.
That's awesome. And if people want to do this, and don't really know shit about gardening, is there anything, you know, you could recommend to get people, a book you could recommend to get people, or two that you could recommend to get people started with growing medicinal herbs or just basic herb gardening in general?
Sure. And I can say, if you're super nervous and don't know shit about gardening, you want to grow some plants, herbs are a great thing to start with. You will gain all kinds of confidence. They are tough. They like it tough. They don't have as many pest issues, or oftentimes any. They don't have as many or any disease issues. These are the plants that most gardeners will use in their garden, their veggie garden, to make it healthier. So this is a good category to start with from that perspective. You get a lot of bang for your buck. And many times, especially on the Front Range there, you guys have access to some great nurseries that might, they're not going to have all of these plants, and there's a million different medicinal herbs that once you get super, super herb nerdism, you'll want to start tracking down. But to get started, quite a few of these will be available in a nursery, just to get your feet wet. But if you want to start from seed, I would highly recommend going to Strictly Medicinals, or it used to be called Horizon Herbs. It's online. They're out of Oregon. They have about 8,000 different types of medicinal herbs, and get their catalog, because that's a great place to start. Rico Check, who has run that, that's his baby. The catalog has so much information, both on usage for these plants as well as cultivation techniques. He's got a couple books on his website that he's written over the years around cultivating these plants as well. And so he's kind of like your one-stop shop for beautiful seeds and educational material around them. And then just depending on which direction you want to go, if you want to start producing these things more commercially or on some kind of scale where you're producing for your neighborhood or for an extra side income, the Organic Medicinal Herb Grower by Jeff Carpenter is the most detailed medicinal herb growing book that I have ever come across. Really, really great. And helps you, you know, decide how many seeds and plants you need per square foot. Really great information. You got to be a little nerdy to read that one. From more of a usage perspective, anything by she's sometimes called the grandmother of American herbalism, Rosemary Gladstar, who's from back east. And she has these wonderful, any of her books are great, really beautifully written, funny, great pictures, and geared oftentimes towards the kind of new user, just really user friendly. Lots of little recipes and a little bit of gardening information as well. So yeah, depends on which side. I would recommend getting all of them.
You know, it's so funny. I bought the Rose Gladstar book, the like the basic medicine cookbook one. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, had like cool little liqueur drinks in there and shit. And I was like, this, I like it because it's like a good cookbook. Like a good cookbook nowadays has like pictures and like, it gives you something to work for. And that's why I like that.
And it, yeah, it's inspiring and, you know, makes you want to get out there and do it. And also having like the liqueurs and, you know, herbs can easily in this place where we're at right now with medicine, that people are getting more into natural medicine, but it's like this, oh, I won't use a pharmaceutical for my headache. Instead, I'm going to use willow bark, and this kind of trade. And that's a good place to start. But these are plants that will do best living with you on a daily basis, consuming these herbs every day, all kinds of different herbs. I probably drink or consume 25 different herbs every single day in various forms, whether it's on my body or in my body. They're just a part of my life, and I don't get sick. I don't have digestive issues. I am in a really strong place from a health perspective. And I think a lot of that is because I consume a very vast array of these plants on a very regular basis. So I'm getting all of these different chemical constituents, and these plants, especially the ones that are grown around the climate that I live in, these plants have adapted to living in this climate, and I can help my body learn and take up the information from their longevity of understanding of this climate and take that into my own self. And, you know, that's a whole another topic. There's a really interesting correlation between which plants grow where and which illnesses are prevalent where, like dengue fever or Lyme's disease. And oftentimes we see where these epidemics are really taking hold, that the plant or the plants that are best used to combat these issues are right there.
Even in New England, where Lyme disease is like popping up out of control.
I don't know. So in New England, like in the States, in New England.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing, like, have you read much of Stefan Bruner? He would be my next, once you're like, oh, herbs are cool, I've got some, but I want to take this to a whole different kind of communication level. Stephen Bruner has written 20-something books, everything from herbal antibiotics to the secret language of plants and all kinds of stuff. So he presents forward this information about Lyme disease, specifically back east. And if you take a map of the United States and you show how Lyme disease is progressing and moving across the country, and then you take the invasive weed list of where a plant called Japanese knotweed is being classified as invasive and invading across the country, they are following almost the exact trajectory.
That's amazing.
And Japanese knotweed is one of the best plants for Lyme's disease. So, you know, whether they both just adapted to a similar climate, and as our climate shifts, they both can live in different places. In one way or another, they're related to each other, not only in their healing capacity, but their ability to survive and move. So oftentimes the herb you need is the one that's right outside your door.
That's amazing. You know, it's so, as soon as you started talking about that, guys, like, oh my God, herbal beer.
yeah, the sacred healing herbal beers.
Yeah. Can you just mention that quickly? Because that was fascinating to me about how beer used to be made with herbs and the hops industry. Came in. And
well, it was so in Europe, and lots of details are lost on me. My mind doesn't work in a really detailed fashion as far as dates and all of that stuff. But in Stephen's book, Sacred Healing Herbal Beers, he goes on a bit of a rant, as he does in many books, but specifically on hops and the usage. You've read his books.
Maybe. No, I haven't, but that's just a glowing.
Oh, like, yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. And if you email him, you should definitely email him, because you will get a fascinating bounce back email. Everybody gets this email, and it's just a quick little story on that. But it'll come back and say, you know, hey, if you like my book, if you're writing to tell me you like my book, you know, thank you. If you want me to do a workshop, I don't do that. If you're writing to tell me you hate my books, you can send all your comments to StephenDoesn'tGiveAFuck.com. I was like, oh my God, like, no matter, even if the president or anybody emails him, they're going to get that email back. That's just his bounce back email. And so his books are smart and witty and well-researched and dynamic, but also, you know, sassy. And he goes on to these little rants. So in this book, he's going into his rant on hops, and he really likes hops for one reason, and that's a sedative. It's a great in sleep aids. It's a really beautiful plant in that respect, but because of its bitter quality, it's useful in beer as well. But before hops came into fashion, we used many different medicinal herbs. Yarrow is one of those herbs. We used meadowsweet. We used heather, all kinds of different herbs over the years. And many of them were more stimulating and also a bit psychoactive. But when hops started entering the scene, the governments were realizing that people who got drunk on hopped beer were more quiet. Like they were not as rowdy. They were not as disruptive to society. And so there was regulation passed that you could not call something ale anymore, which is what we used to call beer. You could not call it ale unless it was made with hops. And this was very much pushed by governments to sedate populations rather than make them all crazy inebriated, like with Yarrow, where you might be seeing little fairies and things like that.
I'm shocked to hear governments would do something like that. That's
so strange, right? A complacent society? What would they want with that?
What's that book called on the medicinal beers? Because he tells you how to make medicinal beers, correct?
Yeah, it's all kinds of different ancient recipes.
Not medicinal, but like weird psychoactive herbal beers, not medicinal.
Yeah. And some of them medicinal, like a chamomile beer to help your digestive tract, and that's a nice calming one. So it's called Sacred Healing Herbal Beers.
That sounds awesome.
And it goes through history, through different time periods and different cultures, and talks about their relationship to fermented alcoholic beverages, how they were made, different recipes they use, what the culture kind of talked about, and what the stories were around that time.
That's awesome. Well, we're pretty much longer than, you know, whatever that I originally told you. So just got a couple last questions, and then I'll let you, we'll go about our day. So you mentioned in passing that sometimes there are prisoners working from the local prison on your farm, and you had talked about how you know, you end up hiring some of those prisoners when they get released.
And so I use them a little bit on the herb farm, but mostly we work together on more public projects like the public food forest in Basalt and other nonprofit work. But I've been working with them for about 4 years on and off.
And how has that been?
It's been amazing. They're incredibly hard workers with tons of talent. And just to get to meet these gentlemen from all across the country, every walk of life that you can imagine, and hearing their stories about how it is for them to be where they are, what took them there. And I don't ask them ever, you know, what they did to get in the place that they're at, but should they want to share that information, then sometimes, especially over weeding a garden bed, we get talking about all kinds of different things. And to one, see the atrocious food that they are fed and how we expect these people to be rehabilitated is amazing. So we get to, one, help these folks understand what really good food tastes like. Cause some of them, you know, even before prison, they came from a place where maybe they didn't have all that many options of diet, but we get to taste really beautiful food, really fresh food. They get to get their hands in the dirt. They get to contribute to projects that help feed and grow herbs for healing people and learn about different skills. Lots of them have tons of skills already, and that was a big surprise for me. There's some of these nonprofit projects would never be where they are without the help of these folks. And, you know, sometimes I get questioned from other people that I work with, like, oh, aren't you nervous to work with them? And I have never, even for half of a second, felt nervous or threatened in any way. These are good folks that, you know, got into some trouble. And a lot of them really are, it's like for some of them are in there for pot, which is now legal. So it's kind of crazy that they're still incarcerated for such thing. But then to see these guys come out a few years later and to see them again and have them come back and work on these projects, you know, of their own total free will has been great. And the herbs, they affect people in such a profound way when they work with them and they cultivate them. So the mint we talked about, but the oat field, when we were harvesting the milky oats at one point, we only had like a half an hour left after doing some of the more nonprofit stuff on the farm before the guys had to go. And this is, so this one group, and I was like, hey guys, like, let's do something really fun for the last half an hour. And so I take them over to the oat field. And they're like, girl, I think that your idea of fun and our idea of fun is way different. And so they gave me a little sass, but oats being that nerving, that like calming to the nervous system, almost always when you work with a plant in the field and you've touched it for long enough, you'll get a very similar effect as to if you had taken it because you're absorbing it through your skin anyhow. And so after about 15 minutes or so, you know, first they're like chatty, like making fun of me and stuff as we're harvesting the oats. And then after a bit, they're just all get so quiet. And one, harvesting oats is this very kind of can be a very meditative process. And you, when you put your fingers around the top of the grass and you pull the seeds off, it makes a really beautiful sound. It's like brrr, as they pop off into your hand. And also when the wind blows through the oats, they kind of rattle. They make a really beautiful sound. And so in a few minutes, they're all just like quiet and smiling. And I got this great picture of them. And I turned around and I was like, see, right? It's fun. And they were like, okay, it's a little bit fun. So that was, you know, it's been great. I've loved having them.
That's awesome. Well, I guess my last question would be, you have a podcast and a radio show up there, right?
I do on the Living Permaculture Show on public radio KDNK. It's also on NPR podcasts, and that's with Jerome Asentowski from the Permaculture Institute. We've been doing that for about 6 years now.
Nice. If people want to hear from you every week, they can subscribe there.
Well, every month.
Every month. So much work.
Every week sounds like a lot.
Yeah, I'm lucky to get like two a month. That's breaking my back.
You're doing good.
Well, what else? If people want to go online and buy your herbs, can they, like, do you have like a tea brand out there that people can go online and buy? Or
sure. Well, I have a product line which uses both my herbs and other herbs as well, and that's mostly teas and topicals. That's called Dynamic Roots. You can find us online pretty easily. And then if folks are looking for more raw herbs or plant material, things like that during the season, I'm completely sold out from last year, which is why I recommend more people grow herbs, because there's a great demand. But Biodynamic Botanicals is the name of that company. You can see us online there. And then there's links to the podcast and a couple TV shows. We do a little local access gardening show with really basic gardening information for guys to check out. And that's with CSU Extension as well. And then, yeah, if anyone is in the Basalt Carbondale area during the season and they want to come get their hands dirty and trade a little bit of labor for a lot of knowledge and a little bit of herbs to take home, they can definitely shoot me an email anytime. We always need helpers.
I mean, that's a cool thing to throw out there, because I mean, just, you know, you at this permaculture class that I've been taking, you know, you were just hanging out at the tables. I didn't even know you were an instructor, and you're just dropping just so much shit on everyone. So I would really recommend to anybody who wants to, you know, try some of this stuff out, and you know, learn more to go up and go up 8,000 feet and, you know, just be,
well,
able,
yeah.
just get your hands in the dirt and, listen.
So that's the best way. Just touch the plants, look at them, smell them. You know, if you want me to shut up and stop talking, just say that. That's cool too. The plants are their own teachers often. And I learn, as much as I've learned from books, I have certainly learned from just out there touching and working with these plants in a quiet way. They have their own lessons to share.
You know, and as that's like the last question I had, I just wanted to send a shout out to Lemon Balm. You know, I, for years I called myself a Lemon Balm activist. It was like the first perennial plant that really just kicked ass over here that we just, and so every year I just have like 30 Lemon Balm plants, and everybody that came over to my house, I just send them home with
get
lemon
some
balm.
Lemon Balm. God, what an amazing, what a beautiful, beautiful plant. Again, for the stress and anxiety angle, really calming for folks, and just smells amazing.
You know, and like you said, maybe it could sense all the stress and anxiety in the house and was just mass proliferating until there was no more stress.
Till everybody was all lemony and relaxed, drinking their iced lemon balm tea.
That's what happened. I guess that's how it happened. I blame the lemon balm now. It's like the Lyme disease.
Hey, if it works.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much for taking all the time and for really, really breaking down how to do this. And, you know, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
The sky is limitless, but the land is not. The void is plentiful, but the world is not. In the sky, there is no chair and no throne among starry vault, and no king who does smile or frown. The watchful cosmic shepherd is the vanity of man.
Oh,
life, however great or mean, is the one and true reward. All that praises heaven, slanders earth. All that praises heaven, slanders earth.
Thank you.